Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio this morning, a snowy morning it is, the host of Ag Matters, Amy Pettit, and she has brought along in her wake a guest.
Well, good morning for another edition of Ag Matters Radio. I have got Mark Austin from the Muskox Farm in here with me this morning. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Amy. How are you?
I am great. I am not loving the weather outside as much as the Muskox probably are, right?
They're probably going to have a last little frolic before spring.
I run into quite a few people this morning on my way here, and everyone's just so frustrated. And I'm like, well, it is March in Alaska. So, you know, it happens, right? I don't know why we're surprised when this happens.
We got one of my herd staff who's enjoying her first winter in Alaska, and I think she's about at her wit's end.
It will bother me more if the wind picks up again.
Yeah,
I would take snow for days if the wind just stays away.
So. That would be a good call.
So anyways, Mark from the Muskox Farm, I have got kind of a list of things that I want to chat with you about this morning, but I want to start, like I have for the last couple of weeks, months, maybe reminding people about the opportunity to pick, click, and give. The 31st, March 31st is the deadline to apply for your PFD, and Alaska Farmland Trust, as well as the Muskox Farm, as well as Radio Free Palmer, three incredible organizations that folks could choose to give a portion of their PFD to. So how have your pick, click, give numbers been this year, Mark? Have you tracked it at all?
You know, this is our first year and we haven't had I didn't realize you could track until afterwards.
So okay.
Enlighten me on that one as we get done.
Yeah, you should. I bet someone on your staff is getting an email maybe once a month or once every 2 weeks with a list of how many contributions and dollar amount you've gotten so far. So you have to check that out and see where you're at. Yeah.
Definitely.
We had a challenge at Alaska Farmland Trust this year to get to 100 contributors. And last time they sent us info, we were at 82. So I'm hopeful that we'll hit that 100 mark. What about you guys, Mike? Are you getting good roll-ins of donations?
Yes. And I think we should be at least where we were last year.
Oh, good.
Each year we have done very well, and we appreciate all the contributions. And of course, the interesting question, as you pointed out, is how do you increase numbers?
Yeah.
Although we're very happy with having a dollar amount, the numbers in this case, because of the contests that are out there, become important.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting, and just a reminder to Alaskans, apply for your PFD by the end of the week, which that reminds me, I need to remind my husband, Tommy, if you're listening. And secondly, you can change your pick, click, give designation through the end of August, actually. So long as you get your application filled out by the end of this month, you have until August to change your designation. So hopefully we'll get lots of Alaskans doing so. So that was kind of the first thing that I wanted to remind folks of. And then, Mark, I have a whole list of things I want to chat with you about, but let's start with that incredible event that you had at the Depot last week with the movie and the crazy wild movie. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that and for folks that weren't there, talk to them about what they missed.
Yeah, that was a great time and thanks for coming. And
yeah.
We have unearthed some video footage of actual old RKO movie short that they'd used to show before full-length features in movie theaters. And it was a documentary from 1957 about the real origins of our project and the first capture and how they went about doing it. So it was fascinating. It was great old-school movie making, really well done. And then followed by a lecture by Dr. Joel Berger, who's one of the preeminent researchers in Arctic ecology and muskox, and he's doing work all over the world. So we're super excited to get him up. He's a entertaining guy. He's incredibly knowledgeable, and it happened kind of quick, so we didn't have a lot of the lead time to get the word out that we might have liked to, but we still probably had 60-plus people that showed up on less than 2 weeks' notice. We're thrilled.
So I want to talk a little bit about the movie because, you know, I'm somewhat familiar with the Muskox Farm and what you guys do and why you do it, but I had never really thought about this concept the way that it first happened, that no one was keeping muskox captively or domestically. No one had them behind a fence. And this group of, were they scientists or what? I guess I missed that part of those because they were really just guys in airplanes, you know, with this crazy idea of how to catch muskox, right? So So talk to us a little bit about that. Like, how did that actually happen? Or
it was an incredible group of people. John Teal, who was our founder, he was an anthropologist. So his whole interest in the project wasn't, it was more about the people who were living in the Arctic at a time when these incredibly rich cultures were crossing over into this place where cash was starting to be a desired part of the economy, and it wasn't. And so he was looking for kind of a homegrown, homespun way to bring bring money into these economies. And so being the groovy guy that he was, he wanted to have a geographically appropriate animal.
Okay, right.
And that's, so it was really, it was more about the people of the Arctic than the muskox. The muskox just lent itself to being, you know, you weren't going to be building heated barns and facilities for an animal that was domesticated in the Mediterranean basin. So for him, it was really about solving a problem with which happened to be the muskox. And so it was all about their fleece and all about the Kivyat and trying to make them available for agriculture.
Yeah. And so in this movie, which was fascinating, like you said, it's a short film, and but they have actual footage from when they went out and caught the first muskox, right?
And it was at a time when, you know, historically,
it almost looked made up. Like, for the record, as you're watching, I'm like, is this real? Like, is this really how they did it? It was just fascinating.
Muskoxen had been protected in Canada as endangered.
Okay.
And so in that era, the kind of the horrible truth about how animals were collected, you know, for zoos or others,
sure,
was they'd go and they'd kill the adults and take the calves. And the Canadian government was absolutely completely against that. And
sure.
They allowed them to capture some calves as long as no one got hurt. They couldn't even take a weapon in with them.
Right.
So it was all about these crazy, and these guys, it's a who's who. When you look back through some of the rosters of people that were on expeditions, I mean, these are name brand people. They were senators and they were famous authors and they were people who are just these, he had this most amazing group of people that followed him. He was a rock star of the day.
Huh.
No one had domesticated a large mammal in 7,000 years. So when he went out and said he's going to do it, he'd go on global lecture tours to talk about what he was doing. The world stopped and listened.
Right. Well, that was kind of the thing with the movie, and the kind of aha moment that I had was that, just thinking about that, like thinking about going out and trying to capture this animal that's never really been done before, and they didn't really know how to do it, and they were restricted in what they could and couldn't use. And then to flash forward, you know, a number of decades, and we're all so lucky to be able to walk amongst the muskox at the farm and see them. And I don't know, it was a really interesting thing. So in terms of that movie, because it is such an incredible clip, where are we going to be able to see that again? When are you going to show it again? Or how can people watch it? Because we've got to do that.
We'll have to do that. It'd be fun to get it back out there. There's actually, we have an old canister of this celluloid that I tried to get digitalized a bunch of years ago.
Right.
And it was deemed too damaged to do it. And I have tried to get through to RKO, to people who own the rights, through anything. I've chased this for years.
Okay.
And finally, it just kind of popped up. And there's another movie that went along with that, and then there's a bunch of footage, and so the whole collective of the footage is pretty amazing. So yeah, we should do that. It'd be a lot of fun. The depot is a great spot for it. I thought it worked out really well.
Yep.
And but it's every now and then I'll see it pops up on like a Turner Movie Classic or something.
Oh, okay.
And so every now and then it surfaces out there in the world.
Well, I highly recommend it. And if folks are interested, you know, follow the Muskox Farm. And if you see an announcement that they're going to show this movie again, I recommend coming out and watching it. My kids were fascinated by it. They were like, wow, look at those guys, you know, like in the canoe with the ropes trying to catch the muskox. It was wild. And we're a family that lives with, you know, large livestock. So we understand, you know, what they went through when these animals are charging at them. And again, they don't have weapons or tools or anything. But anyway, that was great. Thanks for having that last week. I want to remind listeners that you are hearing Mark Austin from the Muskox Farm here on Ag Matters with me this morning. And we're just chatting about all things muskox related. So talk to me about the first event of the year that's coming up at the Muskox Farm.
Well, we are getting ready to have our 31st Mother's Day grand opening. It'll be on the 14th this year. It's pretty fantastic when it's such a fun day at the farm. We have people doing fiber arts. We have music. We have food. And it's just super festive. And to see people bring their daughters, who bring their children, who are on like third generation of Mother's Day at the Muskox Farm. It's such a,
it's
part of the year, and it's great fun for us. We love that. So yeah, second Sunday in March, Sunday in May, the 14th will be our grand opening for Mother's Day.
Okay. And do you know the hours, the time?
10 to 6.
10 to 6.
So. And we'll launch our season then. So we'll be open every day and 10 to 6 until probably just about the end of September.
Okay. And what's the ticket cost to get in on Mother's Day?
Thanks for that. Moms are always free
on
Mother's
lucky.
Day. And everyone else who visits a farm, we just ask to make a donation, and whatever that works for you is great. And
okay.
We just really want to kind of open the doors for the season to our community and have some people come up and check out the new babies. We should have babies on the ground. And
that was going to be my next
about
question.
About 3 weeks or so.
How many babies are you expecting this year?
We actually ultrasounded our 5 cows that we bred this year, and it's looking like we're hoping for 5. There was one in there that was a little bit hard to tell, and so we'll see, but we're hoping for 5 for 5.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. So that's up, right? Last year was only 3, right?
Last year was 4.
4, okay.
And we're really at a place where we don't have any desire to grow the herd.
Right.
So we're at 80 animals right now, and we do have a number of older ones, but they keep getting older and older. We got 2 girls that are going to be 23.
Wow.
Next month. We got one guy that's going to be 20. I gave him bottles in 1997, and he's still hanging around, little
that's
man.
That's awesome.
But she's probably, you know, 4 years past what you'd ever expect for a male to live.
Yeah, and they've made it through another winter, so,
yep.
I mean, that's the hard part,
it's
right?
All downhill now.
Yeah.
Green grass around the corner.
That's awesome. Very good. So 4, 5 babies. And so every year when you name babies, there's a theme. So what's the theme this year? Can you tell us?
That's always a really good thing to get behind us. It's one of the most contentious things we have to go through at the farm every year. It can get a little ugly at times, but we have decided to go with birds.
Birds. Okay.
So a few that have perked up to the top are wren and magpie and... oh gosh, now I have a list. So
Raven,
and yep.
Very cool birds. And where do the names come from? Do you get your members and guests involved with naming the animals?
We do. So usually it's this is a little contentious. My herd manager and I kind of don't talk about it for a while, and then we start talking about it. And of course, there's many in my perspective, lots of absurd suggestions.
Sure.
That are never going to bubble up, and yeah. I'm supposed to be the voice of reason. And so then we end up making a short list of names that are going to be reasonable names that we're happy to carry for the next 20 years. And then from that short list, there's volunteers and interns, and, you know, someone might have a particular contact with it, or someone who's in, they'll pick a name from the list.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, that's exciting. And when will the babies hit the ground? When are they expected?
We will go on probably a 24-hour baby watch in about probably around the 17th or 18th, not really expect, probably 15th, 16th, somewhere in there. Not really expecting.
Of April.
So of April,
2 weeks out.
Yeah, 2 weeks out from baby watch, and then it'll be probably around the 18, 19, 20, 21, but probably more that full third week in April
okay.
would be the most reasonable time to start seeing them.
Okay.
The ground.
And unlike with some livestock operations where you're assisting the mom and you're right there hands-on, talk to us about that process on the Muskox farm, because you guys are pretty hands-off, right?
So we're really hands-off. And I think you could probably still go to our Facebook page, which is The Muskox Farm.
Right.
And you should be able to scroll through some videos. And we did have a great birth that we posted up
there. Oh, okay.
Last year, which was pretty fantastic. So I think being closer to the wild side than the long domesticated cattle side, where you've been breeding for size and stuff, the birth is a really pretty easygoing process. We've not had to intervene. It happens pretty quick. Usually they'll go into labor, and it could be 20 minutes. It could be, you know, 5 or 6 hours.
Okay.
And it's kind of lay the calf down, and I've seen them on their feet in 12 minutes. It's amazing watching
wow.
them pop up and go. And
very cool.
Yeah.
And,
amazing.
So with other breeds of animals, like with the bison on the farm that I live on and the cows on the farm that I grew up on, the animals, the moms that were ready to go into labor would usually separate themselves from the herd. They might go off into the trees or over behind a tussock pile or something. Do the muskox do the same thing? Do they like to get away? And
so we've got all the animals on the farm kind of separated out based on sex. Of course, we're in control of breeding, but also
sure.
on dominance. And so the cows that have been bred, they might be in different places until the first week of April. We'll then separate all the expectant moms into a pasture that's been resting. It's clean, so that we have the greatest success and you know, not having, you know, any parasite problems or anything, you know, having them in a pasture that's been used, heavily used.
Sure.
And so they'll be alone. The calf will be born. We're usually right on top of it because we're watching them all the time.
Yep.
And we like to see some really good bonding for about 2 to 4 hours with the mom, get the colostrum going, that first milk.
Yep.
And at that point, we'll go in and we'll give them 2 vaccinations.
Okay.
And dip their umbilicus in some betadine. We've gotten that down to about I think there's a video. Saw that the other night, too, at the movie. We can do that. It's really low stress, low impact with mom. And one person can go in and do it in about 30 seconds.
That was impressive, that little video clip of the herds person kind of grabbing the calf, and the calf doesn't even really know anything is happening to it. And mom's turn around and eating. And then mom looks back kind of like, what's going on? And by that time she's done, right?
All done. Yeah. So we really want to see that bonding happen and get mom bend the calf. And then we'll give them a few more hours and we'll move them into then a maternity pen, which has been resting for over a year. So cleaned and, you know, we burned it off and then it sat resting for a year.
Sure.
And we'll move them in that. Into the other pen. At that point, we'll put a microchip in the calf just so it's kind of a once and for all. You know,
I didn't know the muskox were microchipped.
They are. Well, you know, it's a closed herd, and we do bring new genes in from time to time. But you know, if you were to lose a change of staff or lose an ear tag or something, then you would lose their identity potentially forever.
Sure, sure.
So it just gives us a permanent means of being able to ID the animal.
That's so interesting. Yep. Also, I mean, we don't have to get into a lot of details about this, but I can remember being at the muskox farm one day for one of our Oktoberfests, and a gentleman was at the counter offering tens of thousands of dollars to buy one of your muskox. So in theory, there's a lot of value to those animals, right? And so if someone thought they could hop a fence and steal a muskox, well, they're microchipped and you could track them down, right?
Double dog dare you to try that one. That's going to be a tough one.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And it's... Yeah, it's really for identity. There's a lot of demand. There's no supply in the world. I get calls all the time. I had a long call, you know, conversation yesterday with a guy who's desperately wanting animals and will do just about anything to do it.
Wow.
So they're not available.
Yeah, and that's not part of your plan at this point, is it?
As for our mission, you know, as a nonprofit, we're a mission-driven organization, and being a breeder is not it. Ultimately, our goal was to bring agriculture into the far north, so it's conceivable that we could at some point choose to really redirect our energies and become more of a breeder.
Sure.
You know, trying to get stock into small farms.
Yeah.
But that's not today and probably not for a while.
Okay. All right. Very good. Okay. So other things that were on my list to chat with you about, we talked about the first event of the year, again, Mother's Day, May 14th. What comes up after Mother's Day? If folks already have plans, but they want to come to a special event at the farm, what's after Mother's Day?
We are really working on a pretty active slate of events. We'd like to do, you know, events so often are those big productions, the Oktoberfest, the running with the bulls. And we're looking at doing lots of little things where, you know, bringing an author in who's got a muskox book and a reading and a little tot walk around the farm, or bringing in, you know, different fiber artists just to do some, you know, smaller stuff. And we're going to try to start getting stuff published as we get closer to the summer. But it should be a very busy summer at the farm for locals who maybe don't feel the need just to come out and, you know, walk around and get the standard tour. They're trying to bring a lot more events. And so we're also working with several musicians to do some kind of concert series up there again this summer.
Very good.
Those have been really well received. Yeah. It's such a beautiful venue for that.
It is.
Tons of fun. So, yeah, lots of little tidbits, but I'll keep track of us for more to come, because we've talked about, you know, really having a very busy slate of events this summer.
Yeah. Last year, I threw the idea at you of yoga with the ox. Has that got anywhere?
There's a little traction on that one.
All right.
Yeah, it's looking good.
That was just making some headlines yesterday down in Oregon. You can do yoga with the baby goats. And I think it was the main newspaper in Oregon had it on the front page. You know, these people, which I don't know. Yoga in the same field or in a neighboring field of muskox sounds pretty cool to me, but having a goat climb all over me while I do yoga, I don't know. Most people do yoga to like relax and, you know, get zen or whatever. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but your doggy down looking over your shoulder.
Right. And you all, you know what happens when baby goats get around. But Anyway, okay, so cool events. So Mike and I discovered last week with our guests that we confirmed this idea that not everyone is on Facebook. So if a person's not on Facebook, but they want to follow what's going on at the Muskox Farm, how can they do that?
We try to keep our website up to date. Facebook is definitely our best just day to day. We do publish on our website, which is muskoxfarm.org.
muskoxfarm.org. Perfect.
Yep. Muskoxfarm.org should keep you up to date with what we're doing. It's not as perfectly timely as Facebook. My staff is a lot better at keeping up with that thing on a daily basis, but we do try to keep it there too, and call us.
Call. Good. Very good. Did you have a question, Mike?
Well, I'm just thinking about all of those wonderful, warm clothing pieces that are made.
Oh, yeah.
And I immediately went back to the process. Well, how is that muskox combed too?
Right. We're heading into combing. Calving and combing, our busiest time of the year.
Combing. Talk about combing.
Right. So we are, everything about the project is all centered around this gentle, sustainable agriculture. And if we start spending time socializing the calf when they're very, very young to trust the handlers that work with them, to not be afraid of the barn, to be able to be handled throughout their life, we then can take them into the barn in the spring, and we put them in a stall about the size of a muskox, and we jump in there with them with a steel-toothed afro pick, and we just gently lift the fiber that the kivu sheds naturally, and all the guard hair stays put, so we just need to lift the kivu from underneath that. And if we've done our work, then the animal's happily going to jump on some feed while we're in there, and we'll just start working out. Sometimes it all releases easily and all at once, and sometimes it'll be releasing in one place more than another place, or the animal starts getting antsy. We'll let them out and bring them back in another day. So it's a process that it will take us about 6 weeks to get through, and from start to finish, just because they're all going to release differently and different times in different places.
And then what happens to all that? Give it the, what's the next step?
So the next phase would be to, from the very beginning, we were one with Umingmec, who most people are familiar with, the cooperative in Anchorage.
Right.
And we were all one. And after our founder passed away in 1982, the people that were trying to shepherd the project into the future, they elected to spin us off as the nonprofit side, and they would remain the for-profit cooperative of knitters. And so historically, we've wholesaled our fiber to them.
Okay.
They have sourced fiber from many places since inception. And so over the course of the last 5 years, we've retained a lot of our fiber to benefit the farm and to really put us on a sound financial footing. So, you know, my thing has always been, we're not worth anything to anyone dead. And so having the fiber to help support the nonprofit, they're still thriving. They're doing great. So we still wholesale some fiber to them based on their needs and our needs. And so some fiber gets wholesaled. The rest of it then goes to a de-hairing mill, which is now in Maine. And it's a pretty amazing process. It pulls out all the guard hair, any VM or vegetable matter, as they would call it, any leaves or grass or anything that might be stuck into it. And secondary fibers come out, and then you're left with just the kivu. After that, it goes to a spinning mill in Virginia and gets spun up into yarn. And then about, as I suppose last year, probably about 6 weeks or 6 months after we sent it off, we got back a whole bunch of yarn. And that's now being readied for just retail sales. We've got a few contract knitters that work with us, and we're also doing something really exciting that we're doing this year is, historically, because kivu is very expensive, it's very, very rare, and it's typically gone into very light, lacy garments that are absolutely beautiful, and I think people tend to, you know, look at them as something that's, you know, pretty elegant.
Sure.
And what we're really trying to—
That you only wear, you know, fancy times, yeah.
So one of the things we're working on right now is really working towards getting into more of kind of a technical line of kivu that would be attractive to a snow machiner or someone who's doing backcountry skiing or mountaineering, mushing, anything that's really going to require someone to want really lightweight, really warm, 8 times warmer than wool. a really high performance garment that's not going to be some lacy little thing that you're going to be afraid to wrap around your neck under your helmet.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's super exciting. Hopefully we'll be seeing some of those things starting to come back through in a little over a month.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. So you said the fiber goes to Maine and then to Virginia and then back to Alaska.
Correct.
Right. And so, and that's a kind of a new development. I don't know if you want to talk about the new mill or anything like that, but I was just thinking about the miles on that Kivute yarn. But you do that for a reason. I mean, it's not because you don't want to do business in Alaska, right? But it's because this is a super specialty operation.
Well, up until about a year ago, there was absolutely no ability to process any fiber into yarn. And suddenly there's two.
Alaska.
Yeah, there's a woman in North Pole who has started spinning Kivute into yarn. She has enough capacity for her own needs.
Okay.
And the other person is, I believe, I'm not sure if they're, I think they're up and running now, and they're using a mini mill. And the mini mill is what we did the first few years. And mini mills are just that. And they're very, very, they're great if you have a dog that you want to spin some yarn, or you have a couple of goats and you want to get some yarn from their fiber. We would hit these bottlenecks. It would put our processing time into 18 or 24 months.
Oh, wow.
Which is impossible. And so we are in a really weird place in that we're way too small to be big and we're too big to be small.
Sure.
So we occupy a really difficult place in the processing. But the last 2 years have been able to avail ourselves of the more commercial processing, and they can do in hours what the mini mills can do in years.
Okay. So it's really efficiency.
It's groundbreaking for us.
Right.
It really is helpful.
And I remember I must have been at the farm one of the days when you were getting some numbers back, and the amount of yarn that you're getting back is greater too, right? Or the somewhere in there was a real increased efficiency.
Yeah, we were. So when Umingmac would get Kivute spun into yarn, they used to feel like they'd get into about a 75% capture of Kivute versus stuff that was separated out. Through the mini mills, we were always getting around 50%. We were thrilled to have the yarn to work with.
Sure.
But we also felt that there was a chance we were losing quite a bit. And so I went to Maine last year to kind of help facilitate the process and see if we could improve on that. And we got our dehairing up to about 77%.
Wow.
Which was really exciting. I mean, it made a huge difference. We did find that after the spinning process, we lost a lot to the card.
Oh, okay.
And the carding is the process where you line up all the fibers so they're going in the right direction. But that's all very high quality, super good stuff. It's just sometimes it's shorter fibers that didn't quite make themselves available. So we are going to be able to utilize that and blend it, which we typically don't do because most people truly want the 100%. But it's still amazing stuff. And I'm looking forward to making some fabric.
Oh.
And, you know, the world's endless. I mean, you start doing things with fabric, anything from a sports coat to a little scoop or whatever the little...
Oh, yeah, the skirts.
The little skirts that are become so...
Insulating
skirts. And so it's really exciting. There's so much you can do with it, and there's no one really doing it.
Right. So if a person were interested in getting their hands on some of the yarn or some of the finished products, where does that happen?
Well, we're going to, again, reopen on Mother's Day on the 14th of May. We'll be 10 to 6 every single day.
Okay.
And the gift shop and the farm will be open. If someone's dying to get a hold of some fiber right now, we're always happy to open the gift shop if someone gives us a call, and we'll try to find a time that works for everybody and get someone in there. But so we do have product now, and we're still gaining inventory going into summer. And
yeah. I wanted to remind people of that part about the gift shop because you guys have some incredible stuff in there. And kids' books, like you mentioned, you know, having authors that have written books about muskox. And just last week, I was actually looking for the book about the muskox that's kind of focused on the Nash farm with the triplets. What's the name of that book? Do you remember? That's an unfair question.
Right.
I'm sorry. But anyway, I was next door at Fireside and I really kind of specifically wanted that book, and they're out of it. So I got the other one, the Itchy Little Muskox, which I love that one too. But, you know, just since our farm neighbors, the Nash property, I kind of wanted to get that one, but I'm sure you guys carry that one do you have that one in the book?
We don't currently have that. That was, it was kind of such a short printing, and I think that they do. Yeah,
it's a special run book.
I think so.
I better get my hands back on it then. Yeah. Very good. All right, Mark. Well, we are about to wrap up. It's kind of crazy how fast that half hour goes, and I kind of dominated the the questions and stuff. So is there anything else you kind of want to add before we wrap up, things that are going on or exciting stuff at the farm? Anything you can think of?
I'd probably just flop it back into just a Wahoo moment for Farmland Trust and just everything you do.
Oh, thank you.
And that Farmland Trust does. It's, you know, we live in a place where we all eat food. I think we all take food for granted. We all want cheap houses, and cheap houses come out of subdivisions, come out of farmland. And so I just think it's really important for everyone just to think about where they are and what they appreciate and then how to support it. And I'd, you know, really encourage people to give, to get the click, pick, give to Farmland Trust and help them to carry out their work. I know that we all live here for a reason, and one of it's probably not to see acres of condos across the hayfields.
Agreed.
So
thank you for that.
Thank you
yep.
for all you do.
We didn't even get into that portion about how the farm, your farm is permanently protected with one of our easements, but we'll just have to talk again because our time is up.